This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from David Rutledge. You're in the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the program. This week, we're getting into a field of assisted reproductive technology that's still very much in its early stages, but it's already causing concern among bioethicists. If you're a woman who wants to have a baby, but you're having trouble conceiving, there are a number of options open to you. But if you want to have not just your own baby, but your own pregnancy, then you might be considering a uterus transplant. To date, there have been around 100 successfully completed uterus transplants, with some 40 live healthy births reported. But a uterus transplant is far from being a straightforward medical procedure. It's a highly managed event from start to finish. First, there's major abdominal surgery. Then there's the need for immunosuppressant drugs, which stop the body from rejecting the new organ, but which also makes you vulnerable to infection. So your health and the health of the fetus have to be carefully monitored. And of course, these concerns come up whenever any organ recipient wants to have a baby. But uterus transplants raise a number of ethical issues that have to do with broader social attitudes to reproduction and families. And that's what we're talking about this week.
A good bioethics is a socially minded bioethics. I think we absolutely, as bioethicists, need to think about the social context and conditions in which women and their partners are making their reproductive choices. And I feel we do need to try to loosen our grip on this commitment that we have, this idealization that we engage in of the biologically related family as the gold standard form of family.
Mayanna Lotz is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney, where she's also chair of the Faculty of Arts Human Research Ethics Committee.
There has been research done in the UK and in Sweden, and also some research done here in Australia, qualitative social science research, talking to women about what it is they desire when they desire a uterus transplant, and talking about, therefore, their desire to experience pregnancy. And we do have to acknowledge, as most bioethicists certainly would acknowledge, that we live in a very pronatalist society. It's also a society that is quite essentialist around what it is to be a woman, and a man for that matter, what femininity is based upon, and therefore that accords a lot of value to those so-called typical feminine experiences of gestating and giving birth. So a lot of women report that they feel a sense of inadequacy, that it is a threat to their sense of their identity as women if they find out that they can't have a pregnancy, maintain a pregnancy, or give birth to a child. And of course, we get this evidence from research with women that are dealing with infertility more widely. And I've done some research myself in a small study last year, about 100 participants in that study. And they also talk about the role that carrying a pregnancy plays in helping them to prepare for motherhood, for parenthood, and for supporting the development of bonds and attachments with the child. So many women perceive both the sort of social expectation and social pressures, or they experience them, but they also regard it to be an important step in the development of bonds with their child. The idea also of being biologically related to one's child is an idea that has a lot of currency in our society and has done for many years.
But when you talk about the importance of pregnancy in forming that bond with the child, isn't that the case that a pregnancy experienced by a uterus transplant recipient would be very different from a pregnancy experienced by a woman gestating a fetus in her own uterus?
Yes, that is certainly true. And there are two key ways that I would identify as being the substantial differences here. The first one is around the complex vascular system of the uterus, which means that a number of nerve endings would not be able to be connected, which means that a woman's sensory experience of pregnancy is going to differ in the case of a uterus transplant pregnancy from that of a woman experiencing an unmedicalized or unassisted pregnancy, if we can call it that. A woman will be able to feel the baby moving, they will be able to feel a baby kicking, and they report that that's the case. But in most cases, it happens a little bit later. It appears that it's somewhat different from the sensations experienced by women in so-called regular standard pregnancies. Of course, the comparison isn't really available to us because the women I haven't yet said anything much about who's receiving these transplants, but the women that are receiving these transplants have not experienced a so-called natural kind of pregnancy before, a non-transplant pregnancy. So they can't make that comparison directly. But it looks like there's some differences physiologically in the experience. So that's the first way in which the pregnancies are different. The second way is around the monitoring, the extent of the monitoring of the pregnancies. So in earlier research with just regular pregnancies, there certainly has been a positive correlation between high intervention, high monitoring of pregnancies, and low affect and lowered experience of the joys of pregnancy for women. So women that are very heavily monitored can become more prone to depression and postnatal depression and can report having enjoyed their pregnancies significantly less than women who are not subject to the same levels of monitoring and scrutiny. And so we've got a potentially increased risk to those psychological impacts. However, I would want to point out something that I think is very important here, and that is a crucial difference between what the research on regular pregnancies has shown us and what research on uterus transplant will show us. Because the women that are experiencing uterus transplant pregnancies have, of course, signed on to this, fully understanding what the processes and protocols are, having no expectation of an unmonitored pregnancy. And so a lot of the time, what that negative affect seems to be arising from in the regular case is from the unexpected nature of that level of monitoring. And this isn't going to apply in the case of uterus transplant recipients.
What about the issue of estrangement from the new organ? There was a famous case of a man a few years back who had a double hand transplant. He had hooks, I think, and then he got this double hand transplant. And then in the end, he decided he wanted to go back to the hooks because he didn't like his hands. He felt estranged from them. I understand people with heart transplants have experienced this. I mean, the uterus is such an important, intimate bridge between the woman and the fetus. Has estrangement been an issue in these few cases, or is there concern that it could be an issue and that the relationship to the baby could be compromised in any way?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And certainly in the early days when us ethicists were writing our early papers on the potential ethical concerns around uterus transplantation, we did point to this other evidence in these other cases as potentially signalling a concern in the uterus transplant case. So far, to my knowledge, there hasn't been anything reported as far as that experience arising. I think there are lots and lots of reasons for that. In the hand transplant case, you know, obviously the hands were very visible to the recipient and didn't look like his hands. We're talking about an organ that isn't visible when we're talking about the uterus. We're also talking about an organ that is only ever going to be temporary, a transplant that's only ever temporary. So I haven't talked through the whole procedure yet, but at the end of the uterus transplant process, the uterus will be removed. And that's in order to cease the immunosuppression for the safety of the woman, and because it's just not warranted to maintain that transplanted organ in the body any longer. So for a woman having received this uterus from another person, it's just for that reason quite, I guess, unlikely that they're going to develop in the course of that, 2 to 5 year period, a sense of estrangement from the uterus. Likewise, I think, again, the danger of a feeling of any kind of impact on their bonding or attachment or sense of connection with their fetus, with their developing child and resulting child, hopefully, I think the danger there is also pretty low. There certainly isn't any evidence yet of it occurring.
What about some of the alternatives to uterus transplants? Gestational surrogacy, for example. Is that a less ethically problematic path to go down?
Again, this is another very complicated question and one over which I think a lot of bioethicists disagree. In fact, many people that I've spoken to would regard surrogacy, gestational surrogacy, as potentially more ethically fraught. So again, referring to the research I did myself, which isn't yet published, this is with young women between the age of 18 and 32. And they just talk about the obvious things that contractual relations may break down and the contract may be reneged upon. There are obviously the background concerns about possible commercialization or commodification of the woman's body, depending on whether the surrogacy is commercial or purely, as we call it, altruistic. But what a lot of young women reported to me as a concern around gestational surrogacy is that even if the woman, the surrogate, consents to the procedure, they believe that they would feel a lingering sense of guilt and unease about the imposition on the woman, even if she's consenting, about that imposition of going through a whole pregnancy and giving birth to a child and then having to relinquish it. Of course, there are also, you know, in the literature, there's also reference to concerns around the ability of those relationships to be managed, even in the case where the contract is seen through and the child is relinquished to the contracting parents or parent, a concern around how to manage that relationship going forward, what will be the relationship of the surrogate to the resulting child. But for many of these young women, I found this very interesting and quite surprising, that they were just, in a sense, a little bit paternalistically concerned, in a positive way, I think, about just women going through this process, even if they take themselves to be fully free and consenting in the decision, to then part with that child and forever deal with the psychological and emotional aftermath, as these young women saw it. So a number of these women said to me they didn't want to be involved in that kind of arrangement, even if it was consensual.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really did surprise me, actually, the number of times that that came out, completely unprompted, I should add, because I really wasn't investigating surrogacy itself, but making comparisons between that and uterus transplant and other options.
We should also just talk a bit about adoption, because that's another alternative. And what sort of bearing do the issues raised by uterus transplants have on adoption law, adoption practice, adoption policy, this kind of thing?
Around the question of adoption, there is disagreement. Some people argue that there really is no alternative to uterus transplantation, and that adoption in particular is no genuine alternative. And they say that's because what a woman seeks when she seeks a uterus transplant is the biologically related child at the end of it. My own view is that we ought to regard adoption to be an alternative, and that is very much based upon my view that the most important aspect of being a parent is actually the social role of parenting and not the contribution that's made by genetics or biology. So I think that we ought to see adoption as an alternative. And I think here we get into some complicated questions around what the current hurdles and obstacles and lack of access to adoption, the role that those might be playing in generating a demand for uterus transplantation. Some of the young women that I spoke to, a number of them, again unprompted, said to me, I would certainly prefer to adopt if it weren't the case that adoption was so difficult and so time-consuming and so intrusive in terms of the processes involved. So the lack of availability of adoption may actually be generating some demand for uterus transplantation, albeit to perhaps, I think, a relatively low level. On the other hand, we should think about what making something like uterus transplantation available might actually do to our broader social goal of trying to meet the demands of these already existing children, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children in the world. And if we go to the quite radical extent of making uterus transplantation not just available to some women, but perhaps even publicly funded and endorsed at a sort of more social level, then we might actually see some reduced attention to meeting the demands and needs of this very significant population of children who have quite poor child welfare outcomes when they bounce between foster homes or institutional care for maybe anywhere from 2 to 8 to 10 placements during the course of their lives. And I would argue, and I have argued, that if we are in the process of making ethical uterus transplantation available to some women, we should be also in the process of committing ourselves to looking very seriously at what aspects of adoption practice and also adoption reform we might need to address changes to, because I think there are reforms that could be made that would be healthy for all participants. I would also just really want to bracket here the very serious concern that we have in Australia, but also in Canada and in the US and also in New Zealand, around the stolen generations and forcible removals. And I think in the case of the Australian adoption law reform context, I would really support substantial Aboriginal self-determination around how the adoption of Indigenous children is managed. And I certainly don't see a one size, one model fits all kind of approach being appropriate. We need to have learnt the lessons from the past, and even some would say the present, the ongoing present. We need to make sure that our adoption practice is ethically sound and sensitive and mindful of good outcomes for children and their families and communities more widely. But with that reservation, with that, you know, caveat firmly in place, and with lots of resources diverted to addressing those needs, I think that we can reform adoption in positive and ethical ways, and that will, from what I hear, that will enable uptake for a number of young people who are interested today in, as they put it, not adding another child to the population when we already have existing children with very significant needs.
You're in the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. My guest this week is Mayanna Lotz. And we're talking about reproductive ethics in general and the ethics of uterus transplants in particular. There is still that pressure, though, isn't there, of conformity to what you called bionormativity earlier in the conversation. You mentioned that. And I want to talk a little bit about that and about a feminist analysis of assisted reproductive technology in general. This is something that came up in a paper of yours that I read earlier this week. And it's the point that society already puts too much pressure on women to have children in the first place. And the last thing we should be doing is developing these risky technologies that only add to that pressure. So we're back to uterus transplants here. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about that critique of the technology?
Yeah, my own thinking has undergone something of a development. I wouldn't say a 180 degree turnaround or anything like that. I did start off being very concerned and cautious about this development of this technology, uterus transplantation, because I just saw those risks as being so high, the medical processes for major abdominal surgeries and immunosuppression and the likes to be so substantial that I felt that, you know, what it was doing was entrenching and valorizing this belief that biological relatedness is so important. And I am still concerned that we send out an endorsement, a valorized message of the desirability of the ideal family and the ideal bonds between people as being biological and genetic. I'm concerned that in supporting women to go to such lengths as uterus transplant involves, that we are inadvertently entrenching these norms. So I think that there's a danger there, but I've now come to believe that, and partly that's through my own contact with uterus transplant practitioners and advocates, everybody wants to do the best they can here for women, both those who are undertaking uterus transplant trials and women more broadly. And so I think while there is a danger of entrenching these social norms, there's a lot that we can do at the same time to try to counteract that, opening up options to women, reducing some bureaucratic barriers and costs around some of the alternatives would be one way in which we might shift people's perceptions of what they feel pressured into, or what society does pressure women into and men as far as their reproductive options are concerned. So I think a good bioethics is a socially minded, contextually minded bioethics. I think we absolutely as bioethicists need to go beyond thinking about adequate informed consent and signatures on dotted lines. We do need to think about the social context and conditions in which women and their partners are making their reproductive choices. And I feel we do need to do what we can to try to loosen our grip on this commitment that we have, this idealization that we engage in of the biologically related family as the gold standard form of family.
I take your point, and yet I've been reading other material about uterus transplants in particular over the last couple of weeks, and I get this sense sometimes that there's an argument that, you know, Assisted reproductive technologies have been around for over 30 years. We've got artificial insemination, that's fine. IVF, that's fine. Gestational surrogacy, yes, that's fine. But then, you know, and these are all ethically problematic in their own ways. But uterine transplants are just a bridge too far. You know, this is a whole separate order of ethical dodginess. Is that something that you go along with?
Look, I think it is a separate order. I don't know about ethical dodginess, but it's a separate...
That's my technical philosophical term.
I sometimes want to use that term myself. I think that there are quantifiable differences here that we need to pay attention to. So I think it is assisted reproduction on a different scale. I do. The risks are higher. The costs are very high indeed. The impacts on resource allocation and priority setting within hospitals is very, very complicated. It's not comparable to IVF. IVF is ethically fraught. It is emotionally challenging and physically challenging. We've got enough to worry about there. And I do think that we do increase the concerns exponentially when we're talking about uterus transplant. And the fact that, you know, for many people, the goal of experiencing pregnancy and achieving a biologically related child are morally less weighty than other goals that we might have, mean that it doesn't look justified either from the point of view of many people to put women at so much risk and society at so much cost and impact. Because, of course, the impact is felt way beyond just the recipient pool and the donor pool even. It's the families, obviously, of both of these classes. And we can have both deceased donors and living donors. There have been three, as far as I'm aware, three healthy births now from deceased donor organs, uteruses. But the impacts on stakeholders are broader than just those constituents, because it does go to questions around subsidisation within our society, around how we manage organ donor registries, how we manage the consenting process for deceased donation and the like. So our stakeholder group is actually larger than is sometimes assumed to be the case, and that's something that ethicists need, you know, to make very clear. But again, I think the you know, fundamentally, we're in the ballgame of quantitative difference rather than qualitative difference. The quantitative differences are significant and should give us pause and should make our selection, our eligibility criteria, our protocols very robust and very ethically rigorous. So that ultimately, I think we will always only ever be doing a small number of uterus transplants. And certainly there are some people who believe that uterus transplantation is a phase, that once people sort of really come to grips with what's involved, that our attitudes are going to shift and there's going to be a fall in demand for it. The demand for it is quite notable internationally at this point. So in time, we may really see that demand drop. I don't know whether uterus transplant is going to be with us to stay. I guess ideally, I would hope there wasn't a demand for it, because people's alternative, their sense of their alternatives was sufficient to make them feel that to go to such lengths isn't going to be warranted.
Well, Mayela, I just have a final question about the difficulty of influencing the development of technologies like these while the technologies are being developed. Because I sometimes have this mental picture of scientists in a lab somewhere and they're just getting on with it. They're just trying to solve the technical problems and make it happen, because that's what science does. And the ethicists are all in a different building across the other side of town, and they're trying to influence the process as best they can. Is that how it works, or is that what it sometimes feels like?
Look, I think there's good reasons for us to be concerned about that kind of silo situation. And I think there is probably too much separation of the ethicists from the early scientists. My own experience is a little bit skewed in this, because I teach biotechnology scientists myself. I take my ethics and my philosophy outside of the classroom as much as I can. I work with one of the uterus transplant teams here in Australia in developing their protocols and seeking their ethics approval. I work as a consultant rather than a member of the research team. So I'm there to give independent critical feedback and advice, and that is what I do. So personally, I engage a lot, and a lot of my colleagues overseas are actually very also very closely involved with the uterus transplant teams there as ethicists and consultants and on patient safety and monitoring boards and priority setting boards. So what I've seen in my experience is a real openness in the case of uterus transplant researchers to concern from ethicists, to hearing ethicists, and to addressing the ethical concerns that are raised. I've attended a number of meetings, including the World Congress of the International Society for Uterus Transplantation. I've been invited to talk to various groups, including donor registry groups and so on, but also the scientists themselves. They're very open, they're very welcome, they're very welcoming, they're very concerned to get the ethics right. And I've directly seen ethicists influencing in a positive way the ethical protocols and processes that are set up around the uterus transplant trials, particularly in Sweden, the UK, the United States, and here in Australia. Those are the ones that I'm most familiar with. So I actually feel hopeful and encouraged by my own experiences and the experiences of those I know in relation to uterus transplant. I agree with you that it can be difficult. It can be a challenge to influence the science as it's developing. I would say that it's an even greater challenge for ethicists to influence the technology once it has been developed, and especially once it has been made available and become accessible to members of the public. To have an impact at that stage is often extremely difficult, sometimes outright impossible. I think in the case of uterus transplantation, we're seeing a very promising model of very close interaction between ethicists and medical researchers. The actual techniques are not substantially new. They are being improved, and ethical involvement in those hasn't really been so critical, I guess, because those techniques around organ transplantation and vascular connections and so on are already quite well understood and well proven in practice. But around the overall picture of how to make uterus transplantation that results in a take-home healthy child as ethical as possible, I actually feel hopeful, and my experience has been quite positive.
Well, there's a hopeful, positive note, and I've been having so few conversations recently that end on hopeful, positive notes, so let's end it there. Mayanna Lotz, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks very much, David.
And Mayanna Lotz is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney, where she's also chair of the Faculty of Arts Human Research Ethics Committee. And that's it from me, David Rutledge, this week. This has been The Philosopher's Zone. You can find streaming and download links to this and all of our programs via the ABC Listen app or the Radio National website. Just look for The Philosopher's Zone on the program menu. And you can find me on Twitter at David P. Zone. Bye for now.